Matthew 9:18 says, "While he spake these things unto them," Pharisees, Sadducees, disciples of John he's talking to, "behold, there came a certain ruler and worshipped him, saying, My daughter is even now dead, but come and lay thy hand upon her, and she shall live. And Jesus arose and followed him, and so did his disciples." Now, the story is that Jesus is now having great resistance from the religious leaders because the scope of his miraculous ministry is affecting everyone. Everyone through the whole territory is coming to Jesus. The Pharisees and Sadducees, the religious leaders, are jealous because of his success. They can't deny the miracles because they're obvious. So what they're saying now is the miracles are done because Christ is doing it through the power of Beelzebub, the prince of devils. They're still trying to disqualify Christ by blaming his miraculous ministry on Satan. And he's receiving that we'll hear about that in chapter 10. So there's great hostility at this point to his ministry. And yet here comes this man who is the ruler of the synagogue in Capernaum, the main synagogue there. His name is Jairus. Jairus, as the ruler of the synagogue, was the one. He was not the rabbi. He didn't conduct the services, but he was the one who was in charge of who taught. He would decide and make out the schedule for who would read the scriptures, first in Hebrew and then again in Aramaic for the people, who would do the teaching. If there was a traveling rabbi that came through, it was his prerogative to give the pulpit, as it were, in the synagogue to the itinerant rabbi. And this man may have handed the pulpit in Capernaum to Christ. This man Jairus may have already sat under the teaching of Jesus. Obviously, he's aware of his ministry in the miraculous to the point that he's willing to come and fall down in front of Jesus and worship him and bear the reproach of the religious system now that was antagonistic to Christ. The Pharisees and Sadducees were hassling Jesus, and this guy, you know, his religion has left him empty. It has given him no answers. His wealth, as the ruler in the synagogue, he was involved with city politics and so forth. This man, all of his wealth was giving him no answer at this point in time. You may have seen Jairus on the lifestyles of the rich and famous. He was a wealthy man, but what he had accrued, the wealth, what had come to him at this point in time is not settling the issue, because all the things that might come to us in life, no matter how much we might gather to ourselves, and I think some people, unbelievers, are in the error, of course, of thinking that if they have more wealth, if they have more fame, if they have more pleasure, if they have more money, if they have more, that they will be satisfied. And obviously we see people, the wealthiest people in the world, divorcing, going to alcoholic treatment centers. Obviously the answer isn't there either. Now, I don't think it's wrong for us as believers to desire good things. I don't think it's wrong for us to want good things for our family and our children. I mean, the Bible puts the responsibility on us to work for a living, to provide, to live with some integrity in this world. I don't think that's wrong. And I think the Lord wants us to be blessed until those things take the place of God in our life, until they start to possess us, and until we come to the point where we're miserable and there's no Christian witness. If we're not getting this that we want, or we're not getting that we want, then there's an error. Then we've gone awry and something is wrong. Well, this man, Jairus, doesn't have, at this point, the hope you and I do. This man, Jairus, is not walking in the light that you and I walk in. This man, Jairus, doesn't know about the resurrection, the crucifixion. He doesn't know about these things. This man, Jairus, has never read this chapter before. This man, Jairus, is not saying to his friends, watch this. He's going to come with me. This woman with a blood flow is going to interrupt us. He's going to heal her. We get to my house. He's going to say, Talitha Kumai, and the whole story is going to be over. That's not what Jairus is saying. He's never read the story. He doesn't have the hope or the light that we do, and yet he has all the worldly possessions. He has a place in his community of respect. He has wealth. He has his Hebrew, his Judaism, his heritage, and religion is not giving him any answer either. And you know, I think that's the interesting thing, is we can, and people can, satisfy themselves with all kinds of things in this world. They can pacify themselves. But there's an issue when it faces us, and that issue is death, that nobody but Jesus Christ can fix. Again, all the world's greatest religious leaders are in their tombs. And the great difference, one of the great differences between what we believe and the other religions of the world, is we believe in the resurrection and have an empty tomb to prove it. Jairus doesn't know that. Jairus doesn't have that light. He comes to Christ. His religion has done him no good. Maybe you're here this morning, you feel that way. The church hasn't done you any good. The synagogue hasn't done you any good. Calvary Chapel hasn't done you any good, and it won't. You need Jesus Christ to enjoy Calvary Chapel. Calvary Chapel will send you to hell if you depend in Calvary Chapel. You better find Jesus Christ. His religion has done him no good, and he's out of answers. He's at that point where he doesn't care. You know, it all pales. It doesn't really mean anything. Some of you know that here. As you face death, your child, your parents, all of a sudden a crisis comes in your life, and all of the other things that you thought were priorities just kind of fade into the background because they don't really matter at that point in time when you're about to lose someone you love. What matters at that point in time is that you know Jesus Christ personally and that you believe there's going to be a reunion again someday. I don't care whether my children are tax collectors, sorry, whether they're the president of the United States, whether they're a trash collector, whether they work in a gas station. I don't care what they do in life as long as they do it like a Christian and they have some integrity in their life. And if I lay on my deathbed someday, if the Lord tarries that long, and my children stand around my deathbed, it isn't going to matter a hoot to me what they do for a living. All that's going to matter is that every single one of them has a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, and I know I'm going to see them again. Well, Jairus didn't have any of that. You know, as Christians, we face heartache. We face these things. They're hard to explain. We don't know why the Lord is doing what he's doing sometimes. But imagine Jairus facing this crisis with no hope, without knowing what we know. And he doesn't have the hope that we have. He doesn't walk in the light that we walk in. And he comes to Jesus. And the only hope he has is this itinerant minister that's been through his area from Nazareth and that's been doing miracles. It's the one glimmer of hope that he does have in his life. So he comes to Christ and he casts everything else, his reputation in the community behind him by falling down at the feet of Jesus when the Pharisees and Sadducees hated him. And he worshiped Christ. Now Jesus begins to go to his house with him and there's an interruption. I don't know what you're like, but I hate interruptions. I feel like, maybe it's just me, maybe I'm just crazy. I feel like we're running out of time. I feel like the Lord is coming. I do not have time to waste. I don't have time to dilly-dally in traffic when there's a tourist in front of me. I don't have time, you know, that my schedule is hectic enough that I make it out. I know I have to have a certain amount of hours to study, to be with the Lord, to get this done. And the thing that I really have to pray is, Lord, give me patience when there's interruptions. Because invariably, this happens or that happens, and I'm standing around. I feel like I want to jump out of my skin saying, yeah. And I'm just, you know, listening with a half an ear or something saying, Lord, you know, it's me and you. You know, you're coming, and we got to get this done here. I don't know what you feel like, but interruptions drive me out of my mind. Well, all the more for Jairus, because his daughter's at the point of death when he left home. He doesn't know it. At this point, his daughter has died. We're not sure how far away he lives from this scene, but we know by the time they get to his house, on the way, his servants will come and say, your daughter's already dead. Don't bother the master. Jesus says, cool it. As they get to the house, the mourners and the wailers, the professionals, are already hired and are already there. So we don't know. It must have been a distance for him to come to Jesus. When he left, his daughter was gasping her last breath. His only child, 12-year-old daughter, I'm sure had been the joy of his life. As they're on the way, this woman interrupts now. It says, behold, a woman which was diseased with an issue of blood for 12 years. So she began to bleed when Jairus' daughter was born. She came behind him and touched the hem of his garment. For she said within herself, if I may but touch his garment, I shall be whole. But Jesus turned about, and when he saw her, he said, daughter, be of good comfort. Thy faith hath made thee whole. And the woman was made whole from that hour. Now, Mark and Luke give us more details in the record. This woman has had an issue of blood, a hemorrhage, for 12 years. In Hebrew tradition, rabbinic tradition, with that kind of a hemorrhage, the cause, they believed, was immorality. So this woman has the stigma on her of immorality, Mark tells us that she has spent all of her money, she's in poverty, on physicians, and is none the better. Some things are the same. Leviticus chapter 15, verse 25 said, if you had a blood flow, you were unclean, that you couldn't touch other human beings, you would defile them, that you had to be outside the camp. So this woman is cut off from the temple. She's cut off from her religion. She's cut off from her family. She's cut off, obviously divorced by now if she was married. She has this stigma of an adulterous owner, and I'm sure she lives quietly in the alleys, begging, going through trash, trying to find something to eat, eking a living out of this world. And I'm sure by this point in time in her life, she's given up all of her dreams. She's not dreaming of a husband and of a family, of children and of school and of grandchildren and of the things that we take for granted. They've all been cut off from her. And I'm sure by this time in her life, she has built up her walls to the point where she is not going to trust anything else. She's tired of being dashed to pieces. One man has had 12 years of joy, and it all is crumbling in one day. This woman, though, you know, I believe Jairus was in a greater crisis because he wasn't used to it. He didn't have 12 years to adjust to it. All of a sudden, the thing he loved most in life was being snatched away from him, and he's in a tremendous crisis. This woman, on the other hand, over 12 years, I'm sure, has put up all of her walls, all of her defenses, learned to live in the byroads of the country, learned to exist. She's probably bitter at God. Bitter at the religion, bitter at the temple, bitter at everybody who's cut her off. She's probably put up all of her walls and made up her mind she's never going to be vulnerable again. She's never going to reach out and touch anybody again. She's never going to trust anybody again because she can't stand to have her heart dashed to the ground one more time. And I hear people in marriage counseling like that, and they've been going through it for 12 years. They've only been married for 4 years. They've been in agony for 4 years. Engagement ring, wedding ring, suffering. They've been through the whole process. And they're saying, you know, I'm afraid to trust him one more time. He always says this, and I'm afraid to put my heart out there one more. And it's that kind of a thing. She's, I'm sure, got all of her walls up at this point in time. And yet Mark tells us that she heard about Jesus. Now, I don't know what she heard. We know where chronologically where this takes place in his ministry. She certainly has heard, I guess, of him healing lepers. And that probably makes her feel welcome, that he touched a leper and healed him. She may have heard that he raised Peter's mother-in-law up off the bed. She may have heard that he's healed a demoniac in Gadara. She may have heard about the man who was lowered down on a pallet, and Jesus called him his child and forgave his sins and healed him. Who knows what she's heard? You know, she may have heard of 1,000 miracles that you and I don't even know anything about. John, at the end of his gospel, says, if we would have written all the things that Jesus did and said, I suppose all of the libraries of the world themselves couldn't contain them, books. He said, but the things we have written, we've written so that you might believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and that you might have life through his name. He said, there's a purpose for the things that are written. So this record here is written for us. We don't know if she's heard of 1,000 other things, but she's heard about Jesus. And evidently what she's heard has sparked something in her. She's heard, you know, this doctor, you know, she spent all her money on physicians. This is a physician who doesn't charge. This is a physician, because he doesn't charge, he doesn't have to spend all his time around the wealthy people. The people can afford medical insurance. Because he doesn't charge, he can spend his time with the tax gatherers and the sinners and the brokenhearted and the downcast. And that's what she's hearing. The unclean. This is a physician that touches the lives of junkies and alcoholics and addiction and broken hearts and broken lives. She's heard about him. And remarkably to me, she forces her way through the crowd to touch Christ. Remarkably to me, bleeding for 12 years, she's anemic, she's tired, she has to be shot, and yet she finds the strength to push her way, it says, through the thronging crowds, because she's saying, if I can touch the hem of his garment, there's something about Christ. And again, I don't believe, you know, it's the hem of his garment. It's the hem of his garment. It's him. It's not the garment. You see, today in the church, there's many people that teach us about faith in faith, not faith in Jesus. If you have faith, you can do this, and you have to have faith, like faith is some tangible thing, and faith is what you need. Faith isn't what you need. Jesus Christ is what you need, and if you have Him and see Him, you will have faith. And we hear all these people just confess it. You know, you got a runny nose, but you don't have a cold. Blab it and grab it. You know, all this nonsense that spreads across our country. This woman, I guarantee you, wasn't looking at the hem of that garment saying, oh, it's, you know, linen will straighten me out. She was saying it's the hem of His garment. It was connected to Jesus. And what she grabbed hold of was the kraspedon. In Numbers 13 and Deuteronomy 22, verse 12, it tells us that the Jewish male had to wear a border on his garment of blue, and that border was signified the relationship of the Jew to heaven. And it was to remind him to be separate from all other people of the earth, and that God loved him. And when she saw that hem on Jesus' garment, it was the first time she understood what it meant. She understood Christ's relationship to heaven. And I guarantee you, as she saw Jesus, it was something in Him that made her want to touch His garment. It was Him. She saw something in Jesus that helped her push through the crowd. And again, the amazing thing to me isn't that she pushed through the people. The amazing thing to me is that she pushed through 12 years of bitterness, that she pushed through 12 years of doubting God and unbelief, that she pushed through 12 years of religion that she was sick of. And Jesus Christ is saying today, I don't know if you've been suffering for 5 years. I don't know what kind of bitterness or abuse you have to push through. I don't know how brokenhearted you are. And I don't know what you hold down inside so that nobody else can see it. And you try to act look cool like it doesn't hurt and you're breaking inside. I don't know all of you personally. I don't know all of your stories. But the remarkable thing, and I think the reason this is in here for us, is because when this woman saw Jesus, she not only pushed through the crowd, she pushed through 12 years of all that garbage. She pushed through 12 years of all that brokenness. She pushed through 12 years of all the bitterness. She pushed through 12 years of all the pain. She pushed through those walls that she put up, and she said, I'm never going to take these down because I never want to make myself vulnerable. I never want to hope in anything again. I never want to trust in anything again because every time I do, somebody steps on me. I'm never going to do it again. She pushed through those walls. To me, that's remarkable. And the reason why, I believe, is because of the person of Jesus Himself. Had nothing to do with just the teaching. It had anything to do with what she was hearing in and of itself. It was Him. I believe as she got close, I believe as she looked at Him, everything was confirmed. And I believe this about you too. If you push through all the garbage, not to Calvary Chapel, not to any kind of a new meeting, not to this or that, but if you push through all the garbage and grab Jesus Christ, you're going to find the answer to your problem. And don't be fooled into thinking it's another addiction meeting, or it's another church, or the Holy Ghost is falling over here, oil's coming off the lamps in this church, people are screaming in tongues and flopping on the floor. That is not where you're going to find it. You're going to find it in the person of Jesus Himself. He alone has what you need, and He alone will give you the courage to push through all of that garbage. And she, to me, that's the remarkable thing as I look at this woman, is that there was something in Jesus that allowed her once again to have hope. Once again, out of all that deadness, to try one more time. And I think that's a remarkable testimony of what it must have been like to look into His eyes and to watch Him minister and to hear Him talk and to see Him with the poor people and the brokenhearted. It brought life back to somebody whose heart had been dead for 12 years. To me, that's remarkable. Jesus then, evidently, she touches His garment. Mark says immediately she feels herself healed, and quietly she's slipping through the crowd. She's slipping away, and Jesus stops and says, "Who touched me?" Peter says, "What? Who touched you? 59,000 people touched you. We're in a crowd. Everybody's," and he said, "No. Many are thronging, but one is touching." That's the difference between faith. The crowd was thronging, but somebody touched. Somebody reached out. To me, that's faith. It's the reaching out to Jesus personally. And she came then crawling, weeping, I believe, because she knows she's defiled the master. She's unclean. She's not supposed to touch other people. She has a blood flow. She touched Jesus. And she's weeping, I believe, because and maybe she thinks he's an Indian giver. She hasn't read the story either. Maybe she thinks he's going to say, "You defiled me, you defiled the crowd, now you're really going to bleed." Sometimes maybe you think Jesus is an Indian giver. You know, all these blessings are in my life, all these good things, I'm not going to let my guard down because he just wants me to enjoy them so he can take them away from me and really test me to see if I'm a real disciple. That's not the way he is. He's blessing you, roll around in it. Be happy because he's blessing, because there will be other seasons in your life. And when the blessing is on, be blessed. And she's thinking, well, I'm going to defile him. Now, I know sometimes you probably think that. You know, he don't even want to be around me. I've blown it. You know, he said forgive, 70 times 7, and that's 490, and I'm already up to 463, and I'm running out of time. And let me tell you something. When this woman touched Jesus, she didn't infect him. He infected her. You see, that's how powerful he is. You're a leper and you touch Jesus. He doesn't get leprosy. You get Jesus'd. See? It flows out onto you. It doesn't flow out onto him. You can come to Jesus no matter how filthy you are, and you don't make him dirty. He makes you clean. That's the good news. And more than that, it says that he looked down at her. She's laying at his feet weeping. She looks up at him and he says, "Daughter." It's the only time in the Gospels he calls any woman daughter. And it means my little girl. He owns her. Like he did the man that was let down on the pallet, the paralytic. He said unto him, "My child." He owned him. Now he owns this woman. He calls her daughter. That's incredible to me. "Your faith hath made thee whole. Go in peace." Now he not only healed her, but he reinstated her. He called her publicly so he could own her in front of everyone. His daughter. Remarkably. Isn't it, women, for some of you, amazing that Jesus Christ will call you his daughter? We don't have to hear your stories. I know you're a rotten bunch. Isn't it amazing that he would take you and heal you and cleanse you and stop your hemorrhaging and put your life back together and call you his daughter? Don't you look forward to that day to stand in front of his throne and hear it right from his lips? He looks down at this woman, he calls her daughter. I think that freaked her out as much as it freaked the crowd. It freaks me out every time I read it. He moves on. Now, I'm sure when he said daughter, Jairus is saying, "Daughter, daughter, great. What about my daughter? You fix everybody else's daughter. My daughter's dying." Dealing with interruptions. I know you go through the same thing. I do this, I do that, I work hard. The junkie down the street hits the lottery, runs $50 billion. I'm supposed to be excited for him, I try to do everything right. God blesses everybody else. I'm sure when he said daughter, it broke Jairus' heart. His heart must have throbbed. It says, the woman was made whole that very hour. Verse 23, and when Jesus came to the ruler's house, he saw the minstrels, the people, the professional mourners. Now, what we don't have included in Matthew is that Mark 5:35 says, the servants of this man now came and met them in the way and said, "Your daughter is already dead. Trouble not the master." I'm sure as Jairus immediately begins to break, thinking, "That old woman, I'm going to get her. I can't believe she stopped us." I'm sure, Jesus immediately says, "Fear not, only believe." He immediately turns to Jairus and says, "Don't be afraid, believe." I was reading Campbell Morgan's commentary on him. He's one of my favorites. And he said he had a 12-year-old daughter at the point of death. And he said the Lord said the same thing. He said he couldn't do anything but think about this story. And the Lord said to him also, "Fear not, only believe." And his daughter passed on to the next world. He said the Lord said to my daughter also, "Talakumai, little lamb, arise." He said she just arose in the next world. And he said, I can't imagine living without that hope. I know 2 years ago when Josh was dying and we were driving to the hospital and he was seizuring, he was vomiting blood, he lost half of his blood. His blood was down to 6. Blood count went from 12 to 6. And I thought he was dying. Kathy was praying in the tongues of men, the tongues of angels, the tongues of Italians. She was going crazy. Joshua's seizure and shaking the blood. And I was driving 100 miles an hour. And I just remember thinking, Lord, if you take him, I'm going to see him again. It boils the gospel down to a very simple thing. It's about forgiveness of sin in the next world. And that kind of a crisis peels away all the nonsense of life. I remember, too, when he got to the hospital, I ran around, took Josh from her. She was covered with blood. I was covered with blood. And he was white. He was pure white. His lips were blue. I'm running in. And I said, my son's dying. You get it? And the lady says, well, what kind of medical coverage you get? You're gonna have to fill out a form. And that woman that tried to interrupt me almost had a blood flow, too. I'll tell you that. From her nose. I said, what? I put my Christianity quietly aside, and I dealt with her. I said, I'll fill out the papers after you're stabilized. You get out of my way, I'll knock you down. Charles Kinsley, a famous writer, said this: the death of a soldier is touched with heroism, and the death of an old man is surrounded with the glory of completion. But the death of a child demonstrates that something is wrong somewhere. And how true it is. The hardest thing at the funeral of a child is with somebody with white hair that's lived their life, it's expected. It's sad, but nobody's ever beaten the odds. But with a little one, there's a million questions. Why? We're a Christian family. Or other people get abortions. They abuse their kids. We love this child. Why? And there aren't the answers, by the way, that I wish that there were. But I thank God that there's an empty tomb in Jerusalem and that there's a reunion ahead of all of us. And there's a day when it'll all be behind us and we'll be together again. Jesus gets to the house and it's full of the mourners, the wailers, even the poorest people in that day. Rabbinic tradition had us said at least had to hire 2 flute players, 1 woman wailer, and whatever else they could afford. That Mediterranean part of the world is very emotional. If you know an Italian family, you know, they can be arguing, fighting, grabbing each other, punching, and you say, oh, calm down. I say, stay out of our family. You know, it's just my, you know, that's just that part of the world, very emotional. And even today, they wail and they cry and carry on. Well, in that day, you hired professional mourners. So by the time they get to the house, it makes me think there's at least a distance in journey. Is the mourners already there? The thing's already taking place. Jesus says to them, she's not dead, she's sleeping. They laugh him to scorn, it says. These are professionals. We've seen 1,000 stiffs. Don't give me that. We do this for a living. You're a carpenter. Get out of here, you know. Jesus says to them, give place. The maid is not dead, she sleeps. And when Jesus shows up, everything gives place. When he shows up in this world, the ACLU is going to give place. Washington, Moscow is going to give place. Jesus is on the scene. I like that. Give place. They laugh him to scorn, but he put them out. It just tells us here in Matthew, when the people were put forth, he took her by the hand and the maid arose. Mark tells us, he said, Talitha kumai, which is the Aramaic that he spoke. It's the exact quotation of Jesus and literally means little lamb, arise. And when I think of that, it's amazing that his voice goes beyond this world. It goes into the spiritual world. He called her back from wherever she was. The hands that set all of the worlds in motion take this little cold hand. And that's an incredible thing to think. He's saying, little lamb, arise. You know, it's infinite tenderness in the sense that it's the voice of Almighty God. It's the voice from eternity that's taken on human flesh. It's infinite tenderness in that it has come from eternity to earth and taken on human flesh. The Bible says this: the voice of the Lord is upon the waters. The God of glory thunders. The Lord is upon many waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is full of majesty. The voice of the Lord breaks the cedars of Lebanon, and the Lord breaketh the cedars. He maketh them also to skip like a calf, Lebanon and Sirhan, the young unicorns. The voice of the Lord brings the lightning and divides the flames. The voice of the Lord divides the wilderness and shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. The voice of the Lord makes the hinds to calf. It discovers the forest, and in the temple everyone does speak of his glory. The Lord sits upon the flood. Yes, the Lord is king forever. And the Lord says, little lamb, arise. That's remarkable. A voice from eternity bending over a little girl saying, little lamb, arise. And he called her back. Called her back to this world of sorrow, by the way. For two reasons, I believe. He called her back for her parents. It's interesting. There are three resurrections before his in the Gospels. He calls this little girl back, and it says she is the only daughter. She's an only child. And Jesus brings her back. The next resurrection is the widow of Nain, and it says she's a widow, and he's her only son. And Jesus brings him back. And Lazarus is the only brother. He's the only boy in the family. And Jesus brings him back. Maybe if they had a bunch of kids, he would have left her there in glory. I think one reason he did it is she was an only child, and God knows well the cost of giving your only child, because he gave his only son, and it was in his heart. And in each case, it was the only. So I think he brought her back for the parents, but more than that, I think he brought her back for you and me. I think he raised the widow of Nain's son for you and me. I think he raised Lazarus for you and me, and I think he got out of that grave himself for you and me. And then look, as I read through these stories, I know they're recorded here for our benefit. I am not going through a crisis today. Maybe you are. It's easy for me stand up here in the pulpit and talk to somebody who's been in pain for 12 years when I haven't, and give you cheap advice. But this advice is not cheap. This vice that here caused the blood of God's own son, and Jesus has recorded this record for us, because when we have 12 years of joy and our life crumbles and falls apart, he wants us to trust in him. And I believe he would say to us today, fear not, only believe. If you're here and you've gone through 12 years of agony, I believe this is here for you, because you need to push through the crowd too. Not just of people. You don't just need to get by Christians, and it's hard to get by them sometimes. You need to get by the church. You need to get by religion. You need to get by your bitterness. You need to get by your unforgiveness. You're going to need to get by all the walls you've set up, and you need to press through that crowd of things and touch him. Because Calvary Chapel will not do you any good. I won't do you any good. Billy Graham won't do you any good. The world won't do you any good. The church won't do you any good. Jesus Christ is the one you're looking for. Him personally. And he's worth tearing down your walls for. He's worth pushing through the crowd, because if you touch him, he'll take the pain away. And I would encourage you, Jesus says he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And I believe that he's still touching. That he's still allowing people to come out from all their walls that they've set up. I believe he's still the only answer in a broken and empty world. If you're here this morning and you don't know him personally, I encourage you to come forward. Pray with us before you leave. We'll give you a Bible. And for those of you who know Christ and you're in pain, look, we know at least the end of the story. At least when we go through our pain, we don't go through it alone like Jairus did. We don't go through it alone like an unbeliever does. At least we have Christ. We have the hope of the resurrection. And that really becomes everything when it comes down to the matters of life and death, and all the things we thought in life were important are shattered. Then we have everything. Let's stand and pray.